Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adusk here on Financial Survival. My guest is James Corbett from The Corbett Report at C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. James has been living in Japan for the past decade, and he's calling in from that locale. So we're going to talk to James. How are you doing, James?
I am not so great. I am a little bit under the weather today, so you'll have to excuse me. I was just joking with Frank, the producer. I may be losing my voice at some point during this conversation, so we'll actually make you work and do a bit of talking today.
That's as our regular listeners understand, that's not necessarily a challenge for me, but challenge to make sense, but it's not a challenge to talk. Let's start with, I've got one here. I'm trying to look for it in my we'll start with this article on terrorists in the New York Times. Europe focuses on emerging threats from smaller crews of terrorists. That's the headline. And the fundamental concern is that these small groups of terrorists, you know, one lone wolf, two guys, three guys, it's hard for government to actually follow them. The larger organizations are relatively easy to spy on, or at least they have been in the past. The article complains that because of Edward Snowden and his releases, NASA's ability to spy on the American people, on our telephone calls, on our email, have been restricted. They can't find the lone wolf who wants to go out and do things and shoot things up and bomb things on their own. And they admit that. They have a problem with this. And even if he's just dealing with one or two other people, hard for them to track. Do you think that these lone wolves are motivated strictly by ideology and or religion, or at least motivated primarily by those forces? And if so, do idealists, ideologues, religious fundamentalists, do they pose a legitimate threat that people need to be concerned about, or is it just a tiny fragment?
There are so many different things to pick apart with this. I think starting with, let's establish, are there religious extremists and others who are motivated by political ideologies or whatever who can and sometimes do perpetrate lone wolf attacks? Absolutely. Is that a potential threat? I suppose it is. But if we put it on the big scale of things, those types of lone wolf attacks, your chances of dying in them are less than your chances of being stung by a bee and dying. So I wouldn't put it up there as one of the fundamental threats to my existence by which I think the entire society we live in should be reordered around that threat. Now, of course, this is the type of threat that in many ways is the wet dream of the controllers, who want to clamp down on anyone and everyone for any type of activity whatsoever that the would-be controllers deem to be potential signs of lone wolf terrorism. And we have seen, of course, this playing out in the last 15 years of the war on terror in ways that are just, I mean, they would be comic if they weren't so serious. And so people can look at the various lists of suspicious, quote-unquote suspicious activity that has been identified by the Department of Homeland Security and its various adjuncts in the United States security theater, including wearing blue jeans, purchasing things with cash, even purchasing coffee with cash, quoting the Constitution. All of these things have been proposed in various different actual DHS documents as potential signs of terrorist activity. So, of course, the end result of this type of, this mortal threat, this threat to the fabric of our civilization, the only possible answer to it would be, well, then we have to identify everyone as a potential threat, as potentially a terrorist, and we have to monitor and control their activities. Of course, I think the real solution to this is to question the underlying assumption that this is some sort of existential threat to our existence. In a free society, are there going to be bad people who do bad things and innocent people get hurt? Yep, absolutely. We're never going to live in that kind of utopia where that's not going to happen. Is that a fundamental threat to the fabric of our civilization? And should we treat everyone as a potential terrorist as a result of these lone wolves? Of course not. And once we realize that the fundamental paradigm of the war on terror is a fraud perpetrated not against these types of lone wolf terrorists, but against the average citizen, the average person, that's when we realize that this is all a game that's being played for political control.
Well, you know, when you talk about the fundamental paradigm, on the one hand, we're saying we've got to watch everybody. If they have blue jeans, if they quote the Constitution, if they read the Bible, whatever. In fact, if they have a pulse, do they have a pulse? We don't even need brainwaves. They have a pulse, they are potential terrorists. That's where they're going, that the enemy is out here in the public. And any one of us might be a terrorist. But the flip side of that paradigm is the presumption that anything the government does is good. You know, some of these people, even though they may be motivated by their faith or ideology or whatever, there's also a question in some people's minds, what happened to the jobs that were shipped over to China? And to what extent did government's decision to eliminate our tariffs or reduce our tariffs and make global free trade possible and thereby diminish the standard of living for the American people? To what extent did that motivate people who were serious about their faith, serious about the Constitution, but they weren't violent? What extent did government contribute to creating these people? You know, somewhere along, do you agree that someone's got to begin to consider the possibility that maybe government isn't the good guys? And to the extent anyone believes they're not the good guys, then maybe government has to start rethinking its own strategies and policies.
Well, yes, of course, yeah.
They're creating these terrorists. These terrorists aren't just springing up out of the Bible, for example. The Bible may reinforce them, but something else has got their, you know, got them aggravated and annoyed.
Well, I think anyone who's listened to my podcast will know that I'm very much sympathetic to the idea that this is being, in a lot of ways, fostered by governments. And some of that is direct and open and declassified documents confirm it when we look at the P2OG operations and other such admitted Pentagon strategy documents to stir up terrorist sentiments in order to flush them out. So actually encouraging the radicalization process. And we've seen that going on through various other types of programs, like the types of materials that were given to the Pakistanis back in the days of the Afghan war in the 1980s against the Soviet Union, the radicalization that took place with the funding and support of the U.S. government that did such things as provide learning materials for these madrasas that taught children how to count by counting the number of bombs and things like this. Those types of materials that were actually literally documentably provided through the auspices of United States funding and things like that. I mean, so there is actual radicalization that explicitly goes on. But I think the other point that you make is also important, that there's a kind of general radicalization that happens in times of extreme economic phenomena like what we're living through right now, the wrenching of the economy from that sort of manufacturing economy where people had a 9-to-5 existence that would at least pay the bills and put their kids through college, to an environment where it's extremely, increasingly difficult for a lot of people to do that. And the end result of that is a type of radicalization that happens. And we could look at someone like a Joe Stack a few years ago, who wrote his little quote-unquote manifesto against the IRS and how they'd basically ruined his life and then flew his plane into an IRS building in Austin. Those types of incidents occur, and it's interesting to look at the official sort of response to those types of Joe Stack type things. They are treated as the anomalies that they are by people who are, of course, economically in peril, but also mentally deranged to a certain extent, and they're treated that way. But of course, these other threats, these other lone wolf attack threats that we're supposed to believe are the threat to our existence, we have to do, you know, basically create entire new government agencies and all of these new powers in order to deal with. And I think that's the double standard, which shows that, again, the government is creating this. It's just a question of how they then deal with the problem that they've created. And obviously, like every other thing that we've talked about, I mean, the government isn't a monolithic thing, and it's not that everyone involved in government is actively involved in this process. But I think at the very top of the power pyramid, the people who really control what's going on, I think they want to foster this. They want the problem so that they can provide the solution, which is already waiting in store, which is the DHS and the various further, you know, layers of hell that they have planned for the American public in the FEMA camps and all of this. And that's more or less somewhere off in the distance, and who knows how far, but it is there. And we have all of the documentation of Rex 84 and all of these other government emergency plans for subverting the Constitution in the event of a crisis. So do you think that people who want more power would look at all of that infrastructure that's in place and say, all we need is a crisis in order to bring this in. Let's not bring in the crisis. Of course, there are people who have a vested interest and even a pretty explicit interest in bringing about the crisis in order to get that solution in place.
You talk about Department of Homeland Security. Do you know what the definition of the homeland is?
The official government? I don't know.
They talk about the Department of Homeland Security. What is the homeland?
That's a very good question. I would assume it's the United States and its territories.
I'll tell you I saw a photograph, and I know that I have it. I put an article on my blog about this, maybe a year ago, and I don't have it right here in front of me. But I can't think of the California congresswoman who is frequently in the news. She was Speaker of the House, Nancy Lipo, Nancy, I can't even think of her last name right now. She was holding a photograph at a chart at a congressional meeting, and she's photographed holding up a map of the world, and they have the homeland is identified on the map as Canada, United States, and Mexico. It didn't have the United States separated from Mexico and Canada. They were all color-coded. They had the same color, and this was identified as the homeland. Now, if that's correct, Nancy Pelosi, in any case, if that's correct, then the homeland is ultimately responsible for the security of all three of these countries. And it may explain why they're not doing much of a job of enforcing the border between Mexico and the United States, because there is no border between the segments of the homeland.
Yes, no, I see exactly what you're saying there. And I haven't seen the picture that you're talking about in particular, but it doesn't surprise me in the least, because we know that through various agreements since 9/11 specifically and accelerating from that time, there have been a number of different agreements that have talked about basically cooperative security arrangements between Canada, the United States, and Mexico. So there was one that was signed, I think, immediately after 9/11, I want to say in the couple of months preceding it, and that was then developed into a framework that became the Security and Prosperity Partnership Initiative, the SPP, which was signed, I believe, in 2005 and was worked on by the governments of Canada, the United States, and Mexico in close cooperation with the chief executives of various multinational corporations, of course, talking about shared security arrangements and standardizing border security and things in order to create a perimeter around North America, security perimeter, they called it. So that was in place in the mid-2000s. There was a lot of protest culminating in the Montebello protests in 2007. Eventually, SPP basically officially kind of came to a dead end. But of course, the work about creating that shared security perimeter has continued since then. So it isn't surprising at all that there would be some sort of official documentation showing the homeland as basically North America, because that's ultimately what they've been working towards. It's somewhat surprising that Pelosi or others would be displaying that, because I think that's more part of the agenda they don't want to quite reveal yet. But again, it doesn't surprise me at all if that is the case.
Well, it was, again, the image I saw was roughly a year ago. I don't recall clearly. But nobody else seemed to pick up on it. Didn't make any head put up a little article on it, but no one else seemed to notice, certainly not in the mainstream media. And it's just interesting. It's more evidence. You know, where does anyone in our government find the authority to somehow wed Mexico to the United States and wed Mexico, United States, and Canada into a single economy? It's certainly the foundation of a new kind of nation. There's no authority in the Constitution to do that, so far as I'm able to see. I know it's a fuzzy area, but Or is it a fuzzy area? Do you think they do have, by means of treaties and whatever, can they create these, a virtual nation by uniting three economies?
Well, they certainly believe that they have that authority. And I wrote about this explicitly in the Forecaster last October, Building Blocks of World Government Treaties and Trade Deals, where I talked about the sort of constitutional framework for subverting or basically bypassing Congress in order to merge economies, merge or just change the law generally. So this does go back some ways. There have been a lot of different discussions about this and different rulings. But yes, long story short, with treaties and trade deals, basically there is a wide berth for things to be done without even the explicit approval of Congress, let alone the approval of the population generally. And unfortunately, that's what we see increasingly with these various FIPAs that are being signed by not just the United States, but governments around the world. These free trade agreements, these foreign investment promotion and protection agreements, the ACTA, TPP, TTIP, TIFA, LOST, all of these various treaties that in one way or another would change or are changing or have changed the actual law of the land and can conceivably actually subvert the Constitution. I mean, there's... Yeah, that's unfortunately the legal precedent that's been set. And in that article that I wrote for the Forecaster last October, I wrote, in 1923, the then Attorney General of the State of Washington, L.L. Thompson, penned an article in the California Law Review entitled State Sovereignty and the Treaty-Making Power, in which he wrote, an unconstitutional law, if enacted by Congress in the original instance, becomes constitutional if passed pursuant to a treaty contract. So there you go. Make a treaty and you can subvert the Constitution itself.
Certainly we live in interesting times. Let's take a break for some commercial announcements. James Corbett and I will be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned. Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addisk here with James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. James is commenting on geopolitics, the economy of the world, the economy of the United States, the economy of Japan. A lot of interesting intellectual articles at his blog. Again, you can visit it at thecorbettreport.com. C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report, or just James Corbett. Type it in. You'll find him. You'll Google it, and you'll find him. I was mistaken. It's under Dianne Feinstein, or Feinstein, Democrat, California. She was the one who was speaking on behalf of the Department of Homeland Security. And I've sent, let me see, when was this published? 2013. Really, 18 months ago, thereabouts, more than a year. 18 months ago, I published the article. And I sent the link out on Skype, and you can see it. You can go to the article if you care to, and there's the image is there. You can see this. They've identified the homeland as North America. They say 13 countries. In fact, they're including Central America in this. They say 13 countries comprise the homeland. Now, this is interesting. And if you're curious,
oh, they're I'm saying sure 13, you, you know, 13 events in the homeland.
At the image. Yeah. And see if it makes much sense to you or if it's important. I wanted to move on to an article that's actually close to a month old from the New York Times. And the headline says, in a test of wills, Japanese fighter pilots confront Chinese. Naha, Japan, an airbase on the southern island of Okinawa, has become the forefront of a dangerous test of wills between two of Asia's largest powers, Japan and China. At least once every day, Japanese F-15 fighter jets roar down the runway, scrambling to intercept foreign aircraft, mostly from China. The Japanese pilots say they usually face lumbering reconnaissance planes that cruise along the edge of the Japanese claimed airspace before turning home. But sometimes, exactly how often is classified, they face nimbler Chinese fighter jets in knuckle-whitening tests of piloting skills and self-control. This was a story from March 8th. all right, almost a month ago. Is this much ado about nothing, or is there a significant test of wills actually taking place between China and Japan in the vicinity of Okinawa?
I wouldn't say it's much ado about nothing, but I would say there is, as always, there's at least two layers to this story, or maybe layer upon layer. And of course, there are the rising tensions in the Asia-Pacific that we've talked about before. China is an increasing naval power, and along with that comes an increasing air power that they're developing right now. And there's the people have talked about F-35 fighter plans having been leaked to the Chinese and things like this, leaked, quote unquote, or somehow stolen, quote unquote. Who knows? Somehow they end up there, and then the Chinese have developed the next generation of fighters, and so we know that arms escalation is taking place, and we can see it reflected even in the official budgets for the Chinese People's Liberation Army and what have you. So there is a growing threat, I suppose, and there are growing skirmishes in both in the water and in the air. So this is a real phenomenon. It's interesting to think of who this phenomenon really benefits in the end. And you'll note that this article that you're referring to, this New York Times article, starts, Naha, Japan, once a sleepy sun-soaked backwater, this airbase on the southern island of Okinawa has become the forefront of a dangerous test of wills. Well, this has its own little political history to it. And for those who aren't familiar with the context here, basically Okinawa has been the host, which is an island quite far away from the main Japanese archipelago. It's quite far apart, and was its own country or kingdom, actually, as it was styled back in the day, before it was subsumed into Japan. But now it is primarily known for the fact that it hosts this Naha air base, and this has been a major point of political contention with the Okinawans, and they do not want the air base there. They don't want the U.S. Military stationed there at all. And this has been something that's been driving Okinawan politics for decades now, and there's been multiple promises, we'll move the base. Eventually they said, yes, we're going to move the base. An entire new government was elected in 2009, I want to say, here, that one of their main promises, we will move the base from Okinawa, and they almost immediately went back on that plan. They eventually said, okay, we'll move the base, but we'll move it to a different part of Okinawa. So it's the same problem. All of this has been going on in the background, and for the population of Okinawa, who has to deal with not only the bother of having these fighter jets and what have you stationed right over their heads, and the occasional helicopters and what have you that crash on a routine basis there, and also the servicemen who rape children and little girls and things that happens on with unfortunate frequency there. So of course the Okinawans are outraged about all of that, but hey, look at this, we're defending you from those Chinese. Look at how many times we have to scramble these F-15s, because what would happen if we didn't? Oh, it's so necessary to the vital security of Japan. Thank God for this American Air Force base. So again, I think there's a deeper level towards this story than just the Japanese-Chinese skirmish. I think there's an internal Japanese skirmish and Japanese-US versus the population of Okinawa that's being addressed here.
What do the Japanese people think about Okinawa? Are they in general inclined to say, let's hang on to it for Japan? Or are they looking at it and say, look, this is more trouble than it's worth. They want to go to China or wherever, let them go. What's Japanese opinion?
Well, the Okinawan people are a different people with a different culture, a different history. They don't necessarily identify primarily as Japanese per se. And I think within Japan, there's an understanding that Okinawa is kind of a separate, a different place. So I don't know if it's really national. I mean, I'm sure there are nationalistic elements here that would see this is part of Japanese territory, but I think most people understand it is kind of its own place with its own culture, but it just happens to be part of under the purview of the Japanese government. I don't think there's any serious talk or ideas that there will be secession anytime in the foreseeable future, but I think people do understand it's kind of its own place, and people treat it as kind of a holiday destination here more than anything. It's kind of an exotic place to go, technically still within Japan.
That's kind of interesting. I'm going on a holiday to Okinawa. Japanese going to Okinawa because it's exotic. Right.
It's kind of like Hawaii, I suppose, for Americans.
That might be. I get that. I guess that. One other point. You mentioned that the plans. At least you implied that the plans for F-35 fighters have been leaked or to China or stolen by China, and the result is China has been able to make extraordinary advances in their air technology, their fighter jet technology. If it were true that the government of the United States has intentionally leaked these plans to China, what's Japan's position on that? Because this is certainly a slap, not just a slap in the face to Japan. If the United States is in any way arming China with advanced technology, Japan cannot be pleased. And is this going to affect Japan's allegiance, loyalty, fidelity to the United States over the years, or is it something they're not thinking about too much at this time?
Well, I think this goes back to that 2D chess versus 3D chess phenomenon we've talked about before, where I think, certainly from the nation state perspective, Japan should be and would be furious with the United States for the various ways that U.S. technology, economic, industrial technology, as well as military technology, has in one way or another ended up in the hands of China over the years. And this is, of course, not something that would ever be admitted, that the U.S. is actively aiding China in developing this technology, but it has come out time and time and time again over the years. In fact, the Bureau of Export Administration, the Office of Strategic Industries and Economic Security Defense Market Research report was released in January 1999 from the U.S. government, U.S. commercial technology transfers to the People's Republic of China, talking about this as a potential security threat, that a lot of these kinds of industrial and other processes, these ideas are being transferred via the high-tech sector into China as part of R&D for a lot of these companies that are moving and increasingly situating themselves in China. So this is a phenomenon that's been talked about for quite a time now, a couple of decades at least. And as I say, with the F-35 and other things, now suddenly the Chinese are coming out with their new J-31 stealth fighter that they say is going to be the rival to the F-35. How is China developing the technology in lock sync with the U.S.? And as I say, it's because apparently some of the F-35 blueprints and other materials have one way or another ended up in the Chinese hands. So yes, the Japanese should be furious about that. But then again, it's the question of, well, what does the Japanese mean? Certainly there are people within the Japanese government or whatever who really do care about Japanese national interests. But there are also those people who are part of the oligarchical structure, which transcends nation state boundaries. And let's keep in mind that the Trilateral Commission, which was founded by Rockefeller and Brzezinski in 1973 to work in cross-border cooperation, specifically includes Japan, North America, and Europe. So Japan, there are significant people in the Japanese power structure who are very much wedded in with the U.S. and the other power players in the Western world, who are part, I think, of the long-term goal of building China up into the big enemy for the 21st century. And that again, is something that I documented in my podcast back in episode 297, I want to say, of my podcast, China and the New World Order, where we looked at the various ways that since the time of Deng Xiaoping, at the very least, the Rockefellers and Kissingers and Brzezinskis and others have been working explicitly, documentably, to raise up such organizations as CITIC, the Chinese investment firm that is part of the Chinese government, but is kind of quasi-private, quasi-public, and it deals with billions and billions of dollars of infrastructure investment that China has been making over the last few decades. That was set up with the explicit help and advisement of people like Henry Kissinger. So again, I think there's a much bigger thing that's going on here that isn't reflected in the nation state interests of Japan or the U.S. or any of these other nation states individually.
Well, I think the fundamental idea behind the New World Order, or at least a fundamental idea, is the abolition of the nation state. They are going to eliminate nationalism, and the interest will be some sort of the fundamental interest will be in a conglomerate of corporations that might be located. Some may be part of the branches are in Japan, and some are in the United States, and some are in Honduras and whatever. And they're pushing us toward a different way of seeing the world, and maybe to our detriment. Is the New World Order going to eliminate our nation states, and will we be better off if that happens?
Is the agenda to eliminate the nation state? Absolutely so. And again, this comes from a lot of different sources directly from the horse's mouth, as it were. I mean, you can look at the statements of someone like David Rockefeller, even in his own memoirs, where he said, if I stand accused of being someone committed to a globalist society and the erosion of nation state sovereignty or something along those lines, then I am guilty and proud of it or something like that. I mean, again, this is not exactly a very secretive agenda that's going on. It's quite explicit in a lot of different ways. So you can read about, Rockefellers and Brzezinski's and Kissinger's and others making those types of on-the-record statements about the end goal. And interestingly, I think that in some ways, perhaps we're led to believe that the only possible way against that is, well, then we must be strongly in favor of these nation states. We must be nationalistic if they want to erode the nation state, which makes sense on a certain level, but I think is an example of the false dichotomy that we're often given, where people will put their allegiance behind a nation state, behind, lines on a map that were created usually for oligarchical interests somewhere back in the sands of time, rather than, I think the true alternative would be a world in which, yes, there is global sort of connections between people, but they are between people, not between nation states, not between international oligarchical institutions, not between centralized bureaucracies, not the World Trade Organization or the United Nations, but direct connections between people across these national boundaries. And I think that's the real prospect for a future of people connecting to each other directly in a peer-to-peer economy that I've talked about recently on my podcast, which is the real thing to pose against this globalist system, which is just going to take the nation-state system as it exists and then apply it to the whole globe. I think what we have to do is deconstruct the idea of the nation-state system and how it functions and why we need these centralized governments. And when we deconstruct that, then we deconstruct these overarching systems of control that they're trying to bring into place.
I'll tell you what, that's an interesting topic, and we'll have to talk about that another time. Whether we should or should not deconstruct the nation states, we can, because I come down on that probably different side than you are right now. I don't necessarily find the loss of nation states to be, to be admirable, and there's problems with it, but we won't get into it because we're basically out of time, and I want to thank you for being on the program. James Corbett, from thecorbettreport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, for some really fine intellectual pieces on geopolitics. James, thank you for being on the program. Look forward to talking to you next Thursday. In the meantime,
thank you for having me. I'm glad my voice made it. Yay.
Good. I'm glad it made it too. All right, folks, thanks for listening. We'll be back soon, Melody and I. And in the meantime, the good Lord bless you, be Melody, Frank, the producer, and James Corbett. Good night.